So, Steve, I don't know if you have any comments at the outset here before Carmen and her team. Want to give another minute? Okay. Maybe we can see if somebody could roust him out. Proceed, Carmen.
Colleagues and friends, as I think we all know by now, all of this risk for a very big earthquake. A little over a year ago, Council heard a presentation on what a major earthquake would do to our unreinforced masonry buildings, or URMs for short. If you weren't worried about earthquakes already, that presentation probably did the trick. In an earthquake, URMs are a significant risk not only to building occupants, but anyone on the street or sidewalk nearby, not to mention the medium and long-term economic impacts from damaged URM buildings would have. Condemned apartments, closed businesses, blocked roads. The city has had some URM retrofit requirements since 1995, but they have been inadequate in addressing the problem. Less than 20% of URM buildings have been upgraded. It is for this reason that after our last session, the City Council directed PBAM, PDC, and BDS to work together to propose new ways to reduce the risk posed by URMs. This is a challenging assignment because unreinforced masonry buildings include some of the city's most historically significant structures, structures that define the character and culture of our neighborhoods and business districts. Retrofits are also very expensive. PBAM, PDC, and BDS have worked with a panel of issue experts, including architects, engineers, historic preservationists, developers, and financiers, to develop the information they'll present to us today. The guiding principles for the development of the URM retrofit recommendations have been to, one, protect the life and safety of the general public and building occupants, two, support Portland's disaster and economic resiliency, three, preserve public and private investment in the city's infrastructure, four, lessen the financial impact for building owners and provide incentives for quick execution, five, preserve the historical nature of URM structures to the degree possible and practical. We now have information and recommendations informed by technical experts and following these principles, but this work is not done. To tell us more about the data, recommendations, and next steps, I'll turn it over to Carmen Merlo, Director of the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mayor, Commissioners, Carmen Merlo, Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. I'm joined today by the project team, and I'm really pleased to have in the audience quite a few members of several of our advisory committees, including the policy committee. So I want to acknowledge their presence here and thank them for attending this session. So in the year that we've given you that overview about unreinforced masonry buildings, we've actually accomplished quite a bit. Thanks to your leadership, we secured funding for the Bureau of Development Services to hire an engineer to update the over 20-year-old URM database. We've convened a couple of advisory committees, and today, really the goals are for us to update you on the recommendations of both the seismic retrofit and the seismic support committees. We want to leave quite a bit of time for to answer any questions, but we want to get your buy-in on next steps. And so to kick things off, I want to turn it over to Amit Kumar, who's going to walk you through the recommendations from the seismic retrofit standards committee.
My name is Amit Kumar. I'm a senior structural engineer with BDS. Before I talk about the recommendations of the URM retrofit seismic committee, I just wanted to give a quick update on a parallel project that we have undertaken, which is the update of our URM database. What is a URM database? It's, as the name suggests, a database of buildings that was created back in 1994. Which was based on a survey of buildings that was done, of all the commercial buildings that was done at that time. So we culled all the information from that and created a database of URM structures. But that database has been pretty static since then. So in the past 20 years, there has been no update done to this database. So the objective of this project was to verify the accuracy of the database that was created in 1995, to remove any buildings that have been falsely classified as URMs, to remove buildings that have been demolished in the interim period, to identify any URM buildings that have undergone, have been retrofitted, and also to update the building attributes such as the use and occupancy of these buildings, and then to coordinate that and update the database with GIS. We have completed an initial review of all the buildings in the original database, and we are approximately about 50% way of having a second review done by a structural engineer. We expect that we would complete this review of the database by February of 2016. Based on that review so far, originally we had about 1,866 buildings in the database. We have identified over 100 buildings that were falsely classified as URMs, but we have added back about 70 of them based on the research that we have done for while doing the research for the update of the database. So we have approximately 1,800 buildings in the URM database at this point, of which 77 of these buildings are owned or city-financed buildings. So here is basically a map of the distribution of URM buildings here throughout the city of Portland. We have blown up maps here. So this is the same map that we have on this, on the PowerPoint, but if you look, this is the same map here, but all the red dots and orange dots on that map are basically all unreinforced masonry buildings that have not been retrofitted. The green dots that you see in here, they are the buildings that have undergone retrofit of the building. Our work has, we have concentrated most of our work on the central business district, and that's the blow up of, you know, this area here on this map. Again, is the same, the green, the red dots are the unreinforced masonry buildings that have not been retrofitted. This is a map of city-owned or city-financed buildings in the city of Portland.
For a minute, and just give us a little, at least anecdotal picture. That 77 buildings sounds like a lot. Given that we have reinforced most, if not all, of our fire stations with the bond measure, given what we did to this building, tell us a little more about the complexion of that inventory of city buildings. I assume quite a few of them are parks buildings, but what is that? What represents that 77?
So a lot of these buildings, the 77 buildings, are city finance buildings. The list that you have in front of you that shows that most of them are apartment buildings in there. Several of them are parks buildings. They could be, you know, and some of them are also water treatment plants, Columbia wastewater treatment plant in there. And I do have a slide later on that talks about the number of buildings that have been retrofitted. I think we have six buildings have been fully retrofitted. Nine of them have been partially retrofitted.
So the column that says true or false, I can't read the heading on that.
Upgrade.
Yeah, so the column is basically saying whether the building has been upgraded or not.
So if it's true, it's
true, it's been upgraded.
Okay.
So based on our initial review of these buildings, we have found that over 109 buildings have been demolished since 1994. 89 of them have been fully upgraded. 129 have been partially upgraded. So if you add all those up, that represents only about 18.5% of a total inventory of the database that of those buildings that have been either demolished, upgraded, or partially upgraded. So just keep that figure in mind, as I'll be referring to that in the later part of the presentation there. As I had mentioned earlier, six of the city buildings have been fully upgraded and nine have been partially upgraded. So that's just a quick update on our URM database update project here. As I mentioned, we'll be completing the complete review of that by February of 2016. So switching gears now, going back to the report of the standards retrofit committee here. This retrofit committee consisted of 10 members, which represent these members represented the groups from were engineers, architects, geologists, historic preservation, and media city staff. We had six meetings between December of 2014 and May of 2015. The meetings were open to the public, and the public had an opportunity to make comments. So the charge of the or the charter of the committee was, first of all, to examine the existing URM seismic upgrade requirements that are there currently in Title 2485 and to determine the efficacy of the existing regulations. Consider if mandatory upgrades are feasible and whether they should be required. If so, if the mandatory upgrades that are proposed, determine what the standard and performance level should these buildings be upgraded to. And then to create a ranking or prioritization system that would result in a higher vulnerability of occupancies being retrofitted earlier rather than later. And then propose a reasonable time frame to implement the recommendations of a committee and consider the interests and concerns of all the stakeholders. So the key recommendation that came out of this committee was that the city should require that all URM buildings be retrofitted. So why consider a mandatory upgrade on these buildings? The primary reason was the current triggers in Title 2485 have not been very effective in reducing the risk of posed by these URM buildings. If you remember the earlier figure that I had mentioned, about 18.5% of the buildings have been retrofitted. So in the past 20 years, only 18.5% of the buildings have been retrofitted in there. So that's not a very effective tool that we have right now. If we continue at this pace, we would have to quadruple the amount of retrofits that have to happen in order to meet the goals of the Oregon Resiliency Plan, which says that we want to have all these vulnerable buildings to take care of these buildings within the next 50 years. The committee also considered data from other jurisdictions, especially in California, and what they found was the jurisdictions that had mandatory requirements showed a compliance rate of about 87% or higher, as compared to jurisdictions which had voluntary requirements, similar to what we have here, which showed a compliance rate of about only 17 to 30%. And that kind of jives pretty well with what our local experience has been. Back in 1994, when 2485 was put into effect, Gottel and Horner, who were the consultants of the city of Portland, they did a study of the different construction types, and what they found was the URM construction type was the only construction type that showed a positive life safety to cost benefit ratio, meaning that the benefit that you get from retrofit outweighs the cost for retrofitting these buildings. What they found was all it needed was an occupant load of one person per every 1,000 square feet in that building when these life safety benefits start to exceed the costs on these buildings. So typically in a URM building, even in a small earthquake, we have seen time over time again on every earthquake that you get collapses of these buildings. Primarily, you have these parapets down here that fall and injure people on the sidewalks down here. And because of the type of construction where the walls are not tied to the floors, you would see the walls separating from the floors causing the building to collapse. So a very simple, straightforward retrofit of these buildings where you raise the parapets down there, tie the walls to the floor would help go a long way in preventing collapses and reducing any fatalities and injuries to the people, both the occupants and the people outside the building. So the mandatory program that the committee came up with applies to all URM buildings. Some of the buildings that have already undergone retrofits would be grandfathered in. And one of the charge of the committee was to create a prioritization system. So what the committee came up with was a five-tiered ranking system which was based on the degree of risk posed by the building. They considered the occupancy type and occupant load and what the function of the building is before and after a seismic event. So what they came up with is this little chart that is there, which ranks the buildings from the highest risk to the lowest risk here. What we have up here is what we call as a URM class 1 buildings. These are the critical buildings that need to function in event of after an earthquake, and they are basically buildings like hospitals, police stations, fire stations, critical water facilities. URM class 2 is the next highest risk, which are basically all school buildings, and what we call as the risk category 3 buildings. These are the high occupancy structures where you have large number of people congregating in one area. Going down to next is class 3 buildings, which are basically, again, a higher type of occupancy, which are, you know, 4 stories or greater in height, or have more than 300 occupants in the lower, in the building, or have more than 100 units. At the bottom of the spectrum here is URM class 5, which is a single-story building, low occupancy, is generally ranging from 0 to 10. These are things like, you know, auto garages and those type of buildings, where the risk is a lot lower. And class 4 buildings in here are basically a catch-all for all the buildings that are not classified as 1, 2, 3, or 5. So once we classify these buildings based on the risk of the buildings, the committee then assign a performance level that these buildings need to be upgraded to. So, you know, the buildings that are classified as class 1, which are the, typically the critical buildings, we want them to be operational in after an earthquake. So we have, you know, required that these buildings be upgraded so that they remain operational after an event. And then at the bottom of the spectrum where we are, you know, the risk is low, the only thing that is required for those buildings is bracing the parapets, tying in the walls to prevent, you know, the failure of these walls, prevent collapse of these buildings. And in between here are the different levels here, and as these performance standards escalate as we go up in the hazard category. Class 3 buildings and class 4 buildings is where we have most of the buildings here in the city, and they are required to be upgraded to what we call as a life safety performance level, which means that in a design earthquake, people can exit the building safely, and then there's still a little bit of capacity left in an event of an earthquake for the buildings not to collapse. So that's the standards that we have that the retrofit committee came up with. So once we establish the performance levels of these buildings, the next requirement was to come up with a time frame for implementing these retrofits of these buildings here. The retrofit standard committee then sought to balance the need for seismic safety improvements in the near term with the need expressed by the building owners to spread the cost of retrofits over time and plan for any potential disruptions associated with these retrofit projects. And so so this balance was basically achieved by, you know, allowing a longer time frame for the entire retrofit while establishing intermediate benchmarks for those URM categories that have extended time frames so that significant life safety benefits are realized in a shorter time frame. So what are these intermediate benchmarks? So the first is basically... and I keep clicking the other one. So the first benchmark is to brace the parapet. So you have this parapet that extends above the roof line. You provide some bracing back to the structure in there. And then to provide a tie-in of the walls to the floor. And so as you saw in an earlier slide, these kind of benefits of doing this work is to prevent the collapse of these buildings. And these doing this is a fairly non-intrusive work, which you mostly do it from outside. You're not disrupting the tenants in the building. So we thought this would require a quicker turnaround to do this. So the retrofit committee said that this work needs to be done within 10 years. The next benchmark was basically to is the attachment of the walls to the floors, and then to brace these walls for out-of-plane bracing here. So in an event of an earthquake, as these walls go back and forth here, they can break, and because of the stresses that are there in these walls, they can break. So we want to brace these. So you can see this little brace back here. So you would have a series of these bracing in these walls. Now, this is a little more disruptive because then you have your tenants that have to be moved out to do this kind of work in here. So the retrofit committee assigned a longer time frame, is about up to about 20 years to finish this work. So the next step is then the complete retrofit of the entire building, which may involve providing some bracing for the entire structure in the building, or to strengthen the floors or sheathing by providing some sheathing on the floors in this. Let's see. So here is a quick table here of what these mean. We haven't talked about the first step, which is requiring a assessment done for each building, which is what we call as an AAC 41. We identify all the deficiencies in the building. That needs to be done in a 3-year time frame. The next step is this 10-year time frame where you're required to brace the parapets, any appendages to the building, and attachment of the walls to the roof. URM Class 1 buildings, which are the most critical buildings in the city of Portland, are required to have a complete seismic upgrade done within 10 years. The others, your buildings are required to just have the parapets braced in the 10-year time frame. The step 3 is the 20-year time frame where you're required to brace the walls to the floor diaphragm and to brace the walls for outer plane bracing. And then the complete upgrade for Class 3 and Class 4 buildings is 25 years with an additional 5 years for demonstrable hardship. Now, in order to enforce the requirements of these recommendations here, the Retrofit Standard Committee had recommended that the Policy Committee come up with a tiered system of penalties, including fines and withholding of future permits, or placarding or revocation of occupancy certificates. So that was the primary recommendation of the committee, was the mandatory seismic upgrade of all the buildings in here. In addition to that, the committee has come up with some additional recommendations, and those are basically, first of all, to eliminate any loopholes that are there in 2485 that we see being used very often to get around the requirements that are there in 2485 now. For historic buildings, we need to engage the historic building community a little bit more to come up with some innovative methods for mitigating the risk posed by these buildings, come up with incentives for these for strengthening the buildings so that we don't destroy our fabric of the city.
By historic buildings, do you mean those that are actually on the register or
yeah,
contributing?
Is that what that that's is? Correct, yeah. Another key recommendation that the Retrofit Standard Committee came up with is to consider the hazards posed by non-URM buildings. Now, URM buildings certainly are one of the most vulnerable type of buildings, but other types of buildings, for example, unreinforced concrete or under-reinforced concrete buildings have also proven to be hazardous in an earthquake. So they are recommending that the City Council consider providing some funding to create a database similar to that of that we have for URM buildings and to develop policies similar to URM buildings for these other types of hazardous buildings. Some other recommendations is tenant notification, basically letting the informing the tenants of the building that this is a URM building which has known to perform poorly in an earthquake. Similarly, disclosures during a real estate transfer and putting placards on the building. The next recommendation was to adopt a seismic rating system. The U.S. Resiliency Council has come out with a rating system for buildings, similar to what we have for, like, example, LEED buildings. We I think City of LA has adopted that at this point. And then to provide some funding to develop the educational programs directed to the building owners and tenants. So the next is, I guess, the big elephant in the room is, what does this, all these recommendations, what would they cost? Now, this was a very complex issue when discussing this. The Retrofit Standards Committee did not go into this issue in too much of a depth. We recommended that the support committee look into this and determine the cost. But we wanted to just take a quick, get an idea of what this might cost as an order of magnitude. It's a pretty, very complex, it's not very easy to come up with these costs in here because it, you know, the buildings are of different sizes. They may have different requirements for historic preservations, whether the building is occupied or not. So there are a lot of variables that were needed to be considered in there. So what we did was we looked at the FEMA P-154 is what it's called. They have cost estimates that were based on a national study that was done of all the retrofits that were done all over the country, and then we localized it here by converting the data to cost of construction here at this, in Portland. And this study was actually done back in 1994, so we have to extrapolate those numbers from 1994 to current costs in there. So just to get an idea of the order of magnitude, what we ended up with is a total cost that we think is in the range of about $1.2 billion. Of that, we figured that the city, the 77 buildings that I had mentioned earlier, the cost for those buildings were in the range of $68 million.
Coincidentally, the same size as the Parks Bond measure that we just passed. So that's quite a challenge. I'm so sorry. Complete what you're going to say, and then we'll get to discussion. Okay. Thanks.
Well, I'm almost there to the end of this thing here. So what we estimated is that of those 68 million, 30 million are based on the city-owned URMs, and 38 million for city-financed URMs. In there. Yes, right. So all these recommendations that we came out from this, the Retrofit Standard Committee, then we passed on to the Support Committee for consideration in developing incentives. And Shelley with PDC led that effort, and she will present that report for the Support Committee.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. My name is Shelley Hack. I'm a business opportunity officer with Portland Development Commission, and I was the lead staff on to facilitate the Seismic Retrofit Support Committee. And so I'm here today to report to you on the work of that body. So we've recently completed our work and published the final report. You should have received a copy of that sometime last week. The charge of the committee was to evaluate the recommend options to provide private building owners, to help private building owners overcome the barriers to complying with the proposed code changes. And I want to highlight that private building owners. I'll proceed without the, okay. So that was the charge of the committee, was to evaluate, to help private building owners overcome the barriers to complying with the proposed codes. And we looked at the private building owners because that's where we thought we'd have the greatest benefit of the work of that body, because most of the URM buildings in Portland are owned by private building owners. The committee was made up of developers, folks in the finance industry, government agencies, owners, engineers, and historic preservationists. There were 11 members to the committee, and they met six times between May and November. So some of the overarching themes in the conversation, and I heard Amit use the word a number of times in his presentation as well, is complex, is that this is a very complex issue. The buildings and the issues around building performance are complex, as well as the issues that owners have based upon the type of ownership, whether it's an individual owning it, whether it's a real estate investment trust. There's a number of elements that go into the decision and influence decisions around how owners approach retrofits. So there also, So the mandatory retrofits will impact owners differently based upon the size, the ownership, the lease structures as well, as well as the investment goals. And as a result, multiple tools are necessary to provide support, to support compliance. The committee also talked about the need to incent early performance, is that although the recommendations that are coming out of the Building Standards Committee include up to a 25 to 30 year compliance period, that the city's resources are best invested in areas that will incent the owners to perform much more quickly than that. And then the last item, and you can't really see it up here, is that some buildings will have to be demolished. There are some owners that won't have the financial capacity or the technical capacity to achieve code compliance, and as a result, there very well could be buildings that will come down as a result. The last item here is that the public dollars should be invested where they leverage the greatest life safety benefit for the largest number of buildings at the least cost to the public. So before the committee met, the staff team did some extensive research on how this issue is being addressed in other areas, other cities, and borrowed heavily from the work of California as well as Seattle. That research resulted in, was summarized in a matrix that was organized into four broad categories of financial assistance, policy, technical assistance, and then information support. This basic structure was used to facilitate the discussion with the committee about individual tools in each of these categories. Each meeting focused on a different category of ideas, and the committee members discussed and debated each option, and then reached agreement or not on whether to recommend that option for further consideration. And you can find, when the report gets here, there's a matrix at the end of it, attachment D, that kind of summarizes all of the tools that were discussed and the ultimate recommendations that came out of that body. Within the financial assistance area, I found it rather interesting is that I think that this is going to be one of the most complex issues, but actually elicited the least amount of debate from the committee. After discussing the various options that were presented, what the committee concluded was that what was needed was a suite of financing tools that could meet the unique needs of the different owners. They agreed that any tool that increased access to capital through a loan program or a credit enhancement, reduced the direct cost of retrofit projects like through grants and fees, fee waivers, rebates, tax credits, or reduced the ongoing operating cost of the building should be pursued. And as a side note, one of the things that we have done as the work of this staff team has moved forward is last session we were successful in getting Senate Bill 85, which is an expansion of what is called the Commercial Property Assessed Clean Energy Program, which creates a new financing tool that can help to facilitate seismic as well. There's still some technical issues around the building economics that we have to figure out before we can actually begin to implement that tool, but it is something that is in the works and being worked on by staff. So the other area that we talked about was a variety of non-financial assistance tools that should be considered to support compliance as well. And in the policy area, those tools included floor area ratio density bonus, developing an FAR marketplace, expediting permit review, expediting permits and review, project review, expanding the targeted exemptions to include water and stormwater, creating early adopter incentives, and then the idea of the post-disaster right to rebuild. So by far the greatest amount of conversation was invested in the FAR density bonus idea, and the committee felt that this was a new source of capital that could be created with little or no cost to the city. There is issues around that, given the conversation that's going on within the city right now around the affordable housing bonus. So there definitely would be a need for some policy discussions around whether or not that is the policy priority for the city.
Before you move on, could you explain the trigger exemptions to include water and stormwater?
Certainly. So right now, that the city code exempts fire safety, landscape, and tree improvements from being triggered if you do a retrofit project, a seismic retrofit project, so you don't have to bring the building up to current fire safety standards as well as the those other elements. The committee would recommend that water and stormwater be added to those exempted upgrades that would be triggered as a result of a seismic upgrade. And I'll turn to Amit to provide a little more technical background if necessary.
Right. So currently Title 2485 basically exempts life safety improvements that would be triggered by when they do a seismic upgrade. As long as you don't decrease the life safety, you're not required to do any other improvements like ADA. And so what the support committee said that they would like to extend that exemption to include any requirements that might be triggered through that would apply to water and sewer.
Why don't we just do, if we really want to get these done, why don't we just say that you don't have to, that they're, everything else is exempt. If you're doing the seismic retrofit, that's all you have to do.
Right. And so as long as the work that they're doing doesn't decrease any safety, that's what they're looking for, I think.
So I'm just wondering about water and stormwater. What else? Is there anything else left on the list, or is it just everything?
So there was also some discussion about the need to increase the transparency within the FAR area, is that right now that is really individually driven, and there isn't a marketplace where people can go to facilitate the purchase and sale of FAR, excess FAR. Sorry about that. And so the committee definitely was in agreement around the idea of a density bonus. There was some debate about whether or not they thought the creation of a marketplace was in the best interest, but there definitely was some interest on the part of the committee.
So. Shelley, could you just elaborate for a minute about how the density bonus in the marketplace would work?
You know, we've been in conversations with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability about how that might work. And there's a couple of different ideas that are floating around, and each is, it has different levels of administrative complexity. So the idea that's resonating at the Planning Bureau now is one of a rebate, that there would be an owner could come in, demonstrate that they have a URM building, proceed with retrofitting that building, and once they've demonstrated retrofit had been complete, then they could apply to the city for a rebate or for the actual allocation of the FAR that they could then go out in the marketplace and sell to recoup some of those costs. So that seems to be resonating at the Planning Bureau because there's not a whole lot of compliance that would need to be implemented. They would have you'd have to demonstrate that you were in compliance with the updated code before you would be given that excess FAR for sale. That said, there's also the discussion about how are building owners going to cash flow the actual improvement. And so another concept that's been discussed is somehow or another creating an intermediary. We've had this conversation at PDC. We have the $5 million that was allocated last fiscal year for retrofit in the Old Town Chinatown URA. And is there a way that we might be able to use some of those resources to purchase excess FAR and then control the release of those funds similar to a construction loan. We have internally we do construction financing as a part of our core business strategies. So we do have the technical infrastructure and the administrative infrastructures to do that. So those are the two key options that we're talking about right now. We really haven't concluded anything. It's just kind of we're brainstorming at the moment. So the other idea or area was that of technical assistance. And again, it's getting back to this question of complexity. Not only is the financing complex, the policy is going to be complex. Technical issues are complex as well. And so what the committee discussed was the idea of whether or not there was a way of creating some standardized, pre-approved retrofit design options. Because one of the challenges folks identified was simply going through the process of getting design approvals is challenging at times. And if there was a way of creating some level of standardization, then that would expedite the process. That said, there was also a lot of debate about, well, is that really practical? And those members that have a heightened level of understanding of the complexity of building performance and building design were kind of cocking their head saying, I'm not sure if that would really work. But if we could figure it out, it definitely would be something of value. I'm not aware of any, but that building performance is Amit's specialty.
Yeah, I think there are a few nominal, upgrades that have been standardized, but again, there has to be a general. It's very difficult to do that because the building varies, and the level of upgrades vary from building to building. What's there in the building, how the building performs. So it's a very difficult and challenging. But we could probably do some very basic standardization.
So the other idea that got a lot of support was the one of creating an ombudsman type position. Again, it gets back to the issue of complexity, and that if the city had a staff person or persons that could work directly with a developer or an owner to move through the approval internal approval processes, and as well as provide some direction on different types of financing tools that might be available, that would be of value to building owners. And then there were a couple of ideas that the committee discussed that were not supported. That was one of creating a contractor certification program. Also the idea of assembling a technical a pool of technical advisors that owners could go to seek assistance with their projects. The committee felt, or many of the committee members felt, that type of investment was better. One, it was better left to the private market to respond to the need, and that government resources would be better invested in other strategies. Okay, and then the final area of discussion was one of information support. And Amit hit upon a couple of these in his presentation. So part of what, and they actually conflict a bit with what came out of the support committee discussion. And so that's part of the reason why we're pulling together the policy committee is so that policy committee can ultimately, reconcile some of the disagreements. So the idea, so the last category, many people remain unaware of the hazards in our region. And so because of this lack of awareness, there's also a financial impact to that, is that the markets don't necessarily value today a seismically reinforced building. And as a result, that makes these buildings a little more difficult to finance or to get the economics to work. So the committee recommended two strategies in this area. One was the placarding of the buildings, the idea that if you are in compliance with the proposed code, the city would issue a placard that would say your building is in compliance with the code, and you could post that on your building so people would be aware of it. Similarly, that if you were not in compliance with the code, that after due process, the city could come in and require the posting of a placard indicating that the building was out of compliance with required code. The other conversation was around creating a multifaceted public awareness campaign, and so this was where a little bit of disagreement came in with the Building Standards Committee, is that they recommended a tenant notification. That conversation continued into the support committee, and after some debate, that group decided or concluded that it was really better handled in a much broader public awareness campaign, that there's a need to inform the public, need to inform owners, need to inform the technical experts that work in this arena about the new codes as well as the hazards. So on the tenant notification side, folks felt that would be better handled through a general public awareness campaign. But that it was important that the city invest in this kind of a three-tiered public information campaign that would focus general information for the general public, add a layer to that training around what owners have to do to comply, because there will be, if approved, owners are going to be, will need some direction and some help. And then similarly, to educate the technical experts about what the new requirements are and how to work in this new environment. There was also limited discussion early on the building rating system. And early on, the discussion was tabled because the U.S. Resiliency Council was in the process of developing their standards, and the committee felt that it didn't make a whole lot of sense for them to spend time investing in something that somebody else was working on, and we might want to look at it after published to see whether or not it made sense to adopt it locally. That information came to the committee very late in the process, and so there was some discussion at the final meeting about the system, or the new rating system. And what the committee concluded was that they really didn't have adequate time to fully evaluate the rating system and its implications, and recommended that be moved on to the policy committee for further vetting. That said, there was some concern on the part of some of the members about the implications of that type of rating system. So then finally, there were two items that were rejected. I mentioned the tenant notification. They also the idea of a real estate disclosure requirement. The committee felt that this is a commercial environment, that building owners and building buyers have a need to do a level of due diligence on their own, and that if implemented, the code's implemented, it will have a three-year requirement to provide a engineer's report to the Bureau of Development Services, and that would be serving public notice for of what the condition of the building was. So that, and as a result, they felt that it would be redundant to current law. So
that would mean that you wouldn't find out until after you built.
I'm sorry?
You wouldn't find out until after you purchased the building.
Not necessarily. I think that once there's this three-year window in which came out of the Building Standards Committee, they would require that all building owners have an engineer's report, and that engineer's report would be filed with BDS. And that once filed with BDS, that would become public information. And so as a part of the regular due diligence process that a commercial building owner should be going through in evaluating their investment opportunity, that would be yet another place that they would be going to gather information about the building. And so as a result, the committee felt that adding yet another layer of notification requirement that would require some level of administrative monitoring, it was best left to that process.
It just seems a bit odd that we're requiring commercial buildings to list their energy rating, but we wouldn't be requiring them to list whether they're earthquake safe. So,
I'm just reporting on the discussion. Yeah.
Okay, well, that brings us to present day. And so we just received the final report from the Seismic Support Committee. We're now getting ready to convene the Policy Committee. And the Policy Committee is stacked pretty heavily with many of these building owners. And they're everything from churches, schools, affordable housing, and of course some city-owned facilities as well. Our first meeting is going to be January 14th. We intend to convene 5 meetings and hold an additional 2 public hearings. And we're still on track to provide recommendations back to council sometime late spring, early summer. I just want to point out to you again that right now the recommendation at this point is for a mandatory retrofit policy. And so we're working now to finesse the recommendations that have come out from both the retrofit standards and the support committee. So I guess with that, we wanted to make sure there was enough time to answer any of your questions.
Well, go ahead.
So I'm not seeing a list of the buildings in each category. Am I missing it? Like you said, there's about 10 buildings in the first category. Do you have a list of those buildings?
I think there were only a couple that were essential.
Yeah.
So Commissioner, on your list of 77 buildings, I believe that there are only 2 that are essential, that city-owned.
I'd like to know if you say in the report that there are 10 buildings that are essential, what are they?
The report doesn't have the list of the buildings included in them, but we are working in as part of the update to identify all these buildings that are in different categories. If you're looking at the report of this retrofit standards committee, there's a table 1 on page 13 that lists the number of buildings in each category, but it doesn't list the address or the name of the buildings. That would be as part of a database of URM buildings.
So I'd like to see that because I'd like to know. And in fact,
We are still in the process of we are updating these buildings. We'll be working with the bureaus to identify the buildings, the function of these buildings, to make sure that they are category 1 or 2 or whatever it needs to be in. That work is still in progress at this point.
Well, I know before I can vote on this, I need to know which of my parks buildings.
Yeah, we'll be.
There are several errors on the spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. Parks doesn't have a parking garage at Rose City Park, and we don't own Mount Scott Presbyterian Church, and we don't own an apartment building.
So we'll be going back to the bureaus, different bureaus, to verify the buildings that we have on our list right now, to vet that out, and then come up with a final. And that would be towards the February is when we intend to have a final work done on that.
So I think that's really important.
Yeah.
I can't, in good conscience, require private property owners to do something that, A, I don't know which of my buildings actually should be on this list, and B, how much it's going to cost. And then the council needs to have a discussion as how are we going to pay for the ones that we're required to
Understood.
Do.
So let me suggest, I'm sure you're going to suggest some next steps, but let me suggest a couple that come to mind. One is as Commissioner Pritch just indicated, although there are issues of fairness and equity and appropriateness to be figured out, in my view of this issue, there really is a difference between the buildings in terms of what strategy we might employ or strategies between the category of buildings that are owned by public agencies, nonprofits, and tax-exempt organizations, primarily churches and synagogues and so forth. This is the microphone on its last legs, we hope. So we ought to figure that out. In other words, Portland Public Schools is a major part of the problem here. They've passed a bond measure. They are incrementally improving their school buildings. Some other school districts have more work to do or less. But there's no market effect to help them. Their property's tax exempt. The fact that it's increased in value, unless they're planning to sell that property, is of no use to them, right? That's different than you or me that might own a piece of real estate in Portland. And so I think to some extent we'll have to bifurcate our strategies, obviously, to deal with that reality. Now, let me talk about the private side. I want to suggest a next step that takes the good work that you've already done on the finance piece and scrolls in Andrew Scott and the folks from the budget office and probably Ken Rust and some other certified smart people in OMF who've figured out how to finance big things. Backing up a little further, I happened to drive to work today, and as I did, I listened to NPR, and they were doing a story about how people will start saving money if they're given the opportunity to take a future pay increase and sequester it into a savings account. In other words, I know I'm going to get a pay raise in June, July, and I'm going to start a savings account that takes my pay increase and sticks it into savings, so I never see it. So people are more likely to save money if they're given that particular vehicle. Well, that's kind of the situation that the city and everyone who owns real estate in the city finds themselves in at the moment. We are somewhere in the middle of a giant rise in values of private property values in the city of Portland. Your guess is as good as mine, as or maybe better, as to where we are on, between the beginning and the end of that run-up in value. But I would submit that we're not at the beginning, and that's pretty obvious, and I don't think we're at the end. So we're all of us who own real estate are riding an escalator of value at the moment. Meanwhile, the city is also on that kind of escalator, though it's more like a staircase, and that is as our urban renewal areas sunset, the general fund is going to see big infusions of tens of millions of dollars of new revenue above and beyond Cal as that happens. So it seems to me that we're kind of both in this boat together. The city needs to require property owners to do something expensive. The city will be gaining additional property tax revenues from those and other property owners. And so if we all kind of signed up for that payroll savings plan that I just mentioned, where as a property owner I say, you know, I'm going to defer some of my gains in order to invest in the safety of my building. And the city says, we're going to defer some of that property tax windfall in order to participate in the investment in the safety of your building. Everybody wins if we do it the right way. I'm not saying it will be entirely and utterly painless. Well, it might be if we take long enough, you know, if it's a 40-year program instead of a 20-year program. But I'm just guessing that the team of those of you who've already worked on the financial piece of this and the others that I suggested might be able to construct that kind of model that over a very long run of 20 years or more, I'd love to get this done quicker, but this is one of those issues where we tend to talk about it for much longer than we actually do it. So I'd rather go ahead and accept that it's going to take a while and set it up so that we actually do it over that period. So I'm guessing that somewhere in that little sketch that I just hashed out there is a possible set of tools that says both the property owner and the public agencies, this wouldn't just affect this, potentially wouldn't just affect the city's property tax revenue, it might also affect the counties, school districts, and others, just like urban renewal does, right? But all those property owners, all those public agencies are benefited if the property they're taxing doesn't ultimately fall down and lose all its value. So again, I think there's a model in there somewhere where if we are indeed on a long rise of property values and tax revenues, hard to see at the moment, but that's where we are. That's what Josh Harwood and others will tell us, that we're in for, well, our successors are in for big gains in general fund revenue 8, 10, 15 years from now. So anyway, I'd like to put all those ingredients into the hands of those financial chefs and see what they can cook up. But it seems to me there might be a way to do that where, again, we'll have to involve some of the folks you've involved in these committees, BOMA, those kind of folks over time to say, how do we actually pull this off? And I would be, if we could put that kind of model together, I would be much more bold about mandates. I'm interested in mandates. I think, again, it's not, if this were Detroit and property values were collapsing and nobody could sell their building, or that was at least Detroit a few years ago. You know, it's a hard case to make, but it's Portland. Everybody's making money. It's just a question of when they're going to cash in and how much. So, anyway, that's. I would like to suggest that those folks join you, Shelley, and others at the table in looking at, because it's both a city financial model and a property owner financial model that we need to figure out. That's a suggested next step by the time we get back to